Even before President Bush declared the military phase of the job in Iraq was over, administration officials, historians, and policymakers were throwing out historical analogies, comparing the occupation of Iraq to that of Germany, Japan, or maybe more pessimistically, Bosnia or Afghanistan. With much of Iraq still in disarray, the argument about historical precedence has not abated. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
During the war with Iraq, there was an anti-administration email joke that was circulating. It went like this. Here are 22 countries the U.S. has bombed since World War II. In how many cases did a democratic government occur as a direct result? There were five ironic choices. O, zero, none, not a one, a whole number between minus one and plus one. It's easy to call this joke ridiculous and point to exceptions, Panama, Grenada, for example, but a recent report from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace was only slightly less pessimistic. It contended that out of 16 American occupations, only four had resulted in a democratic government, Panama and Grenada, Germany and Japan. The first are too small to be considered good examples, but Germany and Japan have been held up by many as appropriate models, and President Bush has used World War II as a metaphor in several speeches, observing that the U.S. did not leave behind occupying armies, but constitutions and parliaments.
There was a time when many said that the cultures of Japan and Germany were incapable of sustaining democratic values. They were wrong. Some say the same of Iraq today. They too are mistaken.
The use of comparisons with World War II has brought dozens of historians into the fray. They've held meetings, written op-ed pieces, and generally raised objections to the analogies. For example, after the defeat of Japan, the Japanese government and the emperor signed documents of surrender in front of General Douglas MacArthur.
I announce it my firm purpose to proceed in the discharge of my responsibilities with justice and tolerance while taking all necessary dispositions to ensure that the terms of surrender are fully, promptly, and faithfully complied with. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan.
The Emperor retained his symbolic status, although he renounced his divinity. Harry Haritunian, the chair of the East Asia Studies Department at New York University, says that was crucial.
It allowed Japan to become exactly what it wanted to be, and it allowed the Japanese to essentially recover much of their pre-war historical, in other words, experience, institutionally, socially, as well as culturally.
You would have to bring back Saddam Hussein, he says, if you want the analogy to work. Many historians, including John Dower of MIT, list a host of other factors that make World War II different. Japan was a pretty homogeneous society, and while the occupation was conducted mostly by U.S. forces, it had enormous international legitimacy. The occupation was planned for 3 years in advance of the surrender, and it lasted 7 years. American troops, some 40,000, are still there. And Haritunian notes that Japan started out as a modern capitalist state even before the war.
It's not as if the American occupation or Americans went into a population that had absolutely no experience, in other words, with liberal economic and political institutions. I mean, and that's an enormous contrast with Iraq, whose modern history has been largely a history of conflict, in other words, tribal conflict, and one leader after another, in other words, trying to weld this conglomerate into a unity.
For Haritunian, a more accurate model for Iraq might be Yugoslavia. Iraq was tacked together by the British, bringing together often warring ethnic groups. Yugoslavia, with its strongman Tito, held disparate ethnic groups together until his death. Historians who specialize in Germany have their own objections to the World War II metaphor. Atina Grossman and Mary Nolan teach at Cooper Union and New York University, respectively, and they wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times titled Germany is No Model for Iraq. The arguments are similar. Germany was homogeneous, and the U.S. was operating in the context of a multilateral alliance universally recognized as having moral force. The occupation was planned long in advance and lasted 10 years. Democracy came gradually, propelled by unparalleled prosperity and the rise of mass consumer culture. But Mary Nolan goes further.
For better or for worse, most of the existing economic structure was left intact, including some of the large corporations. $3 billion of the $13 billion in Marshall Plan aid went to Germany alone. No government in exile was imposed. They worked with people on the ground, many of whom had highly compromised pasts.
And there was another advantage. Any resentment against the occupying forces could be deflected to another longtime enemy of the Germans, the Soviets. Mary Nolan and Atina Grossman.
It's hard to see how you can do that in Iraq. There was no competing power or ideology that might capture the loyalties or the enthusiasm of the German population in the way that we now have a force, a potential force in Islam in Iraq.
Other more recent U.S. occupations seem to carry warning labels as opposed to being examples to emulate. Only limited goals have been achieved in Haiti, Bosnia, and Somalia, such as getting rid of a dictator, ending bloodshed, or hunger. Listening to all of these possible parallels, Rashid Khalidi, who teaches Middle East studies at the University of Chicago, says the Middle East is so steeped in its own history that analogies from outside the region are quite irrelevant. People in the Middle East have their own models and memories.
They're going to have in mind the 150-year history of Western powers arriving as occupiers and claiming not to be conquerors but liberators. So when General Franks or Secretary Rumsfeld or President Bush says this, it's not going to resonate in terms of 1776 and the Minutemen. It's going to resonate in terms of General Maud and the British arriving in 1882 for a temporary occupation that ended in 1956. That's a background against which Middle Easterners will assess and judge what the United States says and does.
Khalidi says people in the Middle East are most interested in the bottom line. How long will the U.S. stay? Second, who will control Iraqi oil? Iraqis and others in the region still have memories of a two-generation struggle to overthrow British control of Iraqi resources. Third, who will be in the government? Hopefully, he says, not people who came to Iraq on the back of American tanks. To sum up the issues, says Khalidi.
Establishment of a real democracy, real Iraqi control over their own resources, a brief but effective stay for foreign forces, and lastly, I would say, some kind of multilateral international basis for the restructuring of Iraq are, I would say, necessary for this to go down as anything but a catastrophe.
But a brief occupation is exactly what some experts see as a prescription for disaster. Eric Schwartz is a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. Schwartz was the project director of the council-sponsored independent task force on post-conflict Iraq. The needs are large, he says, public security, the rule of law, and what he calls a sustained, robust international commitment to post-conflict Iraq.
A commitment of U.S. resources on the order of $20 billion a year for several years. The major part of that should be the U.S. commitment to peace stabilization in post-conflict Iraq, but it will also include large amounts of money for reconstruction and assistance, and it's not something that's going to end in a year or 18 months. I don't even believe it's something that's going to end in a couple of years.
Schwartz believes the risk of chaos occasioned by a quick withdrawal is infinitely worse than any Iraqi resentment stemming from too long a stay. Most would say Iraq is in a state of disorder at present and its future unclear. And historians note that it's here that the World War II analogy breaks down yet again, that after World War II there were food shortages, but the streets of Japan and Germany were mostly calm. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.